Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's nice to see you all this morning. We had quite a wonderful ceremony and celebration last night, and I think many of you were there. And for those of you who weren't, I'm sorry. But Taizan had a very beautiful ceremony. It was a nice celebration of our Sangha together to uphold him. So I'd like to begin this morning with an acknowledgement. So we're here in this building on land that was forcibly taken from Dakota people who had resided here for many years. This neighborhood was also a thriving community of African Americans where Interstate 94 was built, dividing the neighborhood in two and displacing many whose homes were removed to create this thoroughfare. Although we might not have been directly involved, we are called to act to right these injustices wrought on the previous occupants of this place. We must be good stewards of this place and society and empower those who have been marginalized with open hearts and minds, however we can. This is our Bodhisattva vow. This morning, I'd like to talk about dukkha. Dukkha is often translated as suffering. But the literal translation of dukkha is actually a wheel out of kilter, wobbliness, imbalance, that I believe that when there is the imbalance and unbalance and wobbliness in our lives, we often don't know how to deal with it. And our practice helps us respond to this wobbliness. The difficult things in our lives are usually not smooth. When we can face and embrace the difficulties with an equanimous demeanor, we can suffer less. Suffering happens when we don't get what we want and get what we don't want. So last night's Shuso ceremony actually had me reflecting on my own ceremony. And it was an experience of joy and difficulty at the same time. The case I had was Case 94 from the Book of Serenity. Dongshan is unwell. When Dongshan was unwell, a monk asked, "You are ill, teacher, but is there anyone who does not get ill?" Dongshan said, "There is." The monk said, "Does the one who does not get ill look after you?" And Dongshan says, "I have the opportunity to look after him." The monk said, "How is it when you look after him?" And Dongshan said, "Then I don't see that he has any illness." And I would like to read the commentary from this as well. I think it's quite informative. When the ancients were about to go, which means dying, they frolicked in the realm of old age, sickness, and death. Among them, Dongshan was unusual, is unusual. Once he manifested a slight illness, everyone came in to look on him. One monk asked, "You are ill, teacher, but is there anyone who does not get ill?" This monk had an echo in his words. he was presenting his capability in his statement, and he also wanted to see if the sick man had eyes. Dongshan said, "There is. Scratch the itch and the sickness fully remits." The monk said, "Does the one who is not ill look after you?" He carries out this order in reverse, wanting people to know it isn't so. Dongshan said, "I have the opportunity to look after him. If you figure it by conventional feelings, the one who isn't sick should look after the one who is sick." Dongshan says, on the other hand, "I have the opportunity to watch over him." Is this the principle of inquiring after someone's health in the human sense? This monk wanted to see all the way through. He asked further, "How is it when you watch over him?" Here, it's necessary that you should always serve and honor at all times, going to sleep late at night and getting up early to ask how they are. Only then is it known that you are someone who knows to be grateful and obeys filially. Dongshan said, "When I watch over him, I do not see that he has any illness." This is where everyday practice empowers you when you're dying. So my teacher, Dokai, gave me that case to study and reflect on. And my Shuso ceremony was in 2012, and this case has been a constant companion to me ever since. It's just part of my life that I can always depend on to look at that case when I get wobbly and imbalanced, and I need to know how to take care of myself when I'm ill or when I'm suffering deeply. I think that's the crux of that case. So, for my Shuso ceremony, which was down in Hokkyoji, it was Memorial Day weekend, and that weekend, Hokkyoji had many things going on. So we had an annual meeting of the Sangha on Friday and Saturday during the day. And then on Sunday morning, there was a student who was receiving ordination. And then after that, it was my Shuso ceremony. So we had all kinds of stuff going on, and it was very, very busy. And I think the Zendo had just gotten reoriented, and there was so much going on. And because of causes and conditions with so much going on, there wasn't a lot of rehearsal time. And so people were kind of tired, including myself, excuse me, after everything that was going on. And so at the beginning of my Shuso ceremony, when those of you who were here last night probably saw, there's lots of ritual and formality and bowing to this person and bowing to that person and all kinds of choreography. And I completely screwed up the choreography. You know, and the person who was supposed to help me had her head buried in the book to see what she was supposed to do, and I'm standing there, and it's like, what do I do now? And it's like, oh my goodness. And at Hokkyoji, behind the altar, there's a front door and a back door. And behind the altar was the back door, and I had to go around the back of the altar to come back to Dokai or something. And I was walking around the back of the altar, and it was very tempting to run out the back door. And yet, I knew I couldn't do that. And so although I was extremely wobbly at that time, I just kept breathing and going. And so once I was able to sit down and answer questions, I was very intimate with this case. It was close to me. And so that went well. And it was so nice when people had nice things to say to me, even after all this stuff. And so, and my husband happened to say some very poignant, lovely things. And so that was redeeming for me. And so there was joy and there was suffering. And so I was incorporating all of those things. But I'll say that after the Shuso ceremony was over, I suffered and grieved for a couple of months. It was very painful to me that this ceremony I was looking forward to, probably for years, didn't go the way I wanted it to, and I got what I didn't want. And I had to embrace that and experience it in every part of my body. That's what Dokai would say. If there's something difficult in your grieving or on your suffering, you have to feel it and embrace it in every cell of your body. And so I did. And as I went on, the pain got less and less. And you know, it became my mud where a lotus can bloom, can grow. And last year, I think I spoke about my friend Miosin Karkazinski, who is a dear friend of mine who lived in Hokkaido. And he had esophageal cancer, and unfortunately, he died. But during the time he was ill, I sent him this picture that Dokai and I had Miosin be the doan at the ceremony. And I sent him this picture of him being the doan at the ceremony. And he wrote back to me and he said, "I'm so grateful to you and Dokai for letting me be the doan." And this was one of the highlights of my time at Hokkaido. When I read that and received that, my whole attitude towards my Shuso ceremony turned. And I felt this great joy that this was so meaningful to my dear friend Yosin. So things are never one way or the other. Difficulty and non-difficulty can arise at the same time. So the first noble truth is dukkha. The third noble truth is called sukha. And sukha often is defined as happiness or bliss or well-being. And so there's ways that dukkha and sukha just are companions to each other. That there is not sukha without dukkha. And opposite. So for me too, you know, they're talking about this practice of everydayness. And in our lives, there's always birth and death, and we're always being born and we're always dying. And we need to learn to accept our dying as well as our living. And they're not separate. Dying is living and living is dying. So the day after my Shuso ceremony, when I was at Hokkyoji, or maybe that afternoon, we were in the kitchen, Dopai and myself, and we were washing the dishes. And I've always had great joy on standing next to Dokai and washing the dishes. To me, that's the true Dharma transmission between the two of us. So actually, when I did do the Dharma transmission ceremony with Dokai, after our experience with the Shuso ceremony, we had it all down. And it's a private ceremony, and it was beautiful. And my friend Shokin Weinkauf was there to witness it. And he had been in both ceremonies, and he said, "You guys really got this down." So it was like, yes, it took years, but I think we got it down, that my teacher and myself just completely digested each other's hearts, and we got it down. So my mother used to say this, to make lemonade out of lemons. And I wanted to talk about my niece Karen's wedding. That in Fort Lauderdale a couple of years ago, on Labor Day weekend, there was one her wedding was planned. And that weekend happened to be the weekend that this huge hurricane was coming to the coast of Southeast Florida. And they had the whole weekend planned out, but the wedding was supposed to be on Sunday, and there was people coming from all over the country. And on Saturday night, like 50 or 60 people were going to go to this bar restaurant and see a drag queen show. And I was looking forward to that. I was like, it was something I had never experienced for myself, and I thought that will be very cool. And then Sunday was going to be the wedding. And so this hurricane was coming in, and this wedding was going to be on a boat that was like moored to the back of the where the hotel is, or docked at the hotel. And so because of the causes and conditions of the weather, Karen changed everything. Like on a day's notice, that, a wedding that had been planned for months. And thankfully, nobody had booked the boat on Saturday. So she changed everything from Sunday to Saturday, like 2 days before the wedding, and the caterers and everything, and the band and everything. And it was a beautiful wedding. It was a beautiful wedding, and we all enjoyed it. And there was this huge difficulty, but she took care of things. Like Dong Shan had the opportunity to take care of himself. Karen was taking care of herself and her family and friends with equanimity, and changed her wedding. So it was quite amazing that we have a choice of how we deal with our difficulties, whether we're going to be balanced with them or going to be all over the place, wobbling and wallowing and complaining. We always have a choice, and our practice helps us to meet what's coming our way with balance and to not get keeled over and out of kilter too quickly. I wanted to read this piece from Harada Roshi, who's a teacher named Daigaku Rume, who is at the Confluence Zen Center in St. Louis. And he has been coming every year for the last 4 years to co-lead a session at Hokkyoji with Dokai. And Harada Roshi is his teacher, and Daigaku actually lived at a Japanese monastery for about 30 years. And I think so he was very immersed in the Zen practice there. And Daigaku is this very Caucasian man who's about 6'6" and a string bean. And so he stands out in a crowd, I'll say, and particularly at a Japanese monastery. But he completely immersed himself. And he translated his teacher's different Dharma talks. So this passage is called Deluding Passions Are Enlightenment. Within our minds, there's a cat called greed. There also is a cat named anger, and another called folly or ignorance. In Buddhism, we call these the three deluding passions. These passions or desires are the source of all our suffering. However, if there was no greed, we would not be able to do zazen. Without anger, the determination and enthusiasm not to lose out or be beaten would not arise. Without ignorance, there would be no reflection or introspection. For these reasons, I would like you to understand that greed, anger, and ignorance are also other names for Buddha nature. It is only because we are used by greed, anger, and ignorance that we've come to think of them as being bad. Shakyamuni Buddha also said that the deluding passions are themselves enlightenment. If you sit in shikantaza, which means just sitting, and let whatever thoughts appear, and I'm changing this a little, and do not get caught by them, then they will definitely turn into enlightenment. You may recall the expression, everyday mind is the way. Anger, ignorance, and greed, as well as all kinds of anxiety, impatience, and irritation, exist within the everyday mind. This is called everyday mind as it is the way. I would like you to realize that it is a mistake then to throw away something bad that is inside us. In Buddhism, however, everything is Buddha nature, so there is nothing to throw away. The problem lies within your thoughts or how you think. Inevitably, you cannot accept your thoughts, so you create distance between you and them. But as I often say, zazen is the way to verify that you and your thoughts are one. We practice so that we can confirm this. So here's another personal story. So a few years ago in 2015, in the fall of 2015, I was all set to go to Green Gulch, which is a Zen place in California, near in the Bay Area, for an 8-week practice period. And my life is a little complicated with family and different stuff, and It was no small thing, as my friend G.D. Onryu would say, to arrange this 8 weeks, and I was really looking forward to it. And my daughter had a lump on her breast, and breast cancer is prevalent in my family. And so we went to the Breast Cancer Institute at Abbott, and thankfully my daughter didn't, it was a benign tumor, but I felt like, okay, I need to get a genetic test because there's a BRCA gene mutation in my family, in the women in my family, that is indicator of a proclivity for breast cancer. So I was 57 years old, and I was like, no way am I going to have this gene mutation. The women in my family who had breast cancer had it in their 30s, and I was way past that time, and nothing happened, and so I was sure. And yet, when the test came back, I did have that gene mutation. And so my doctor said, you should have your ovaries out as a preventative measure. And so that happened. And when they took my, there's also a proclivity towards ovarian cancer. When they took my ovaries out, there was cancer there, which was quite a big shock, momentarily. And so this lump on my daughter's breast saved my life. I almost felt like I wish I had the lump to put on my altar. But I didn't, figuratively, I guess. So then my doctor told me, you know, it was only at stage one or stage two, which is very low, and ovarian cancer usually has no way to be detected. And so people often don't find out about it until it's much farther along. And so after about an hour of feeling upset, I felt really grateful. It changed, you know, that when I found out I had the BRCA gene, I was very upset, and then I called my teacher Dokai and told him, and he said to me, is this a diagnosis? And I said, no. And so it wasn't any more at that moment than somebody who has an inclination towards heart disease or something else. It's just an indicator of something that might happen. And so that helped me let it go fairly quickly. And then this gratitude came in. And then instead of going to Green Gulch for 8 weeks for a practice period, the day I was supposed to go to Green Gulch, I started chemotherapy. And it's interesting because I just dealt with what was, and I didn't have a lot of grief over not going to Green Gulch. Became my new practice period. And at that time, I invited many people to join me to see what illness was about. And in some strange way, people came out of the woodwork who I hadn't seen in a long time. And people who I might not have had the best feelings towards came to see me. And what seemingly should have been a really difficult painful, wobbly time became my time of greatest joy in my whole frickin' life. It's like all these people came. And they came for me. You know, I was so surprised. And it ended up being this real pivot time for me. And so sometimes, or if we can, we can have our practice inform the most difficult times in our lives and change them from something wobbly and where we can wallow and have difficulty to something of great joy. You know, it was just seemed like such an oxymoron, but it just happened. And I wasn't looking for it, and there it was. So I think I wanted to share this little poem that I'm sure many of you know, that my friend Etgar Susan Nelson shared with me many years ago when she was doing chaplaincy training. It's called An Autobiography in 5 Chapters by Portia Nelson. And I don't think it's a relative. So the first chapter, I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Second chapter. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I still don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I am in the same place. It isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it there. I still fall in. It's habit. It is my fault. I know where I am. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole on the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down a different street. I think this really encapsulates our practice and our relationship to dukkha and to sukha, to the wobbliness in our lives that we can create suffering from, and a way to change our lives and find joy and well-being. So I want to end with one of my favorite verses that's at the end of the meal chant, and I'm using the old translation. In this world of emptiness, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. Nothing surpasses the boundless mind. Thus we bow to Buddha. So please, if you have questions or comments. Dragons and elephants. You say in the Shuso ceremony. Give me your question.
I love everything about that talk. Thank you. And it kind of reminded me of like just the connection and like the importance of support. And kind of that importance of like Fish has a similar story about her Jukai ceremony. She said she was just kind of like, she didn't really understand that Jukai was a big deal when she did it. And then I think it was the Diwan said, "I would be honored to be part of that." And that like totally transformed her. But, I think the story's enough. I don't need to make a commentary, but it just reminded me of this, of the importance of like supporting each other and holding up the forms. And also that poem reminded me of like there's certain teachings that just are always in my head. But Kyoko said to me once, like, when you're doing something, just evaluate, is this good, bad, or neutral? And sometimes I have to be saying it's bad for years and years and years before I change it.
Yeah. But I think our presence can really change things, our perspective of things that have happened to us in the past. Victoria, it's good to see you. Victoria is from Fargo and she's here for the weekend.
Always had a fear of new things. But I always do new things because there's so much in the world that I would like to do that's new. And it's always good. But I always have a great fear of new things. And before I do anything new, I'm scared. And I have these reactions that go on, and they're not positive until the new thing starts to happen. Like coming here, for example. And then I feel wonderful. But because I've always had such a good experience with new things, I keep doing them despite my fear. My fear is pretty large, so I've gotten used to it. And I have to fight with it and push past it to do the new thing. And your talk has now allowed me or provided me with an opportunity of how to approach this fear for new things with more of a knowledge that to welcome that fear perhaps of the new thing and know that that comes part and parcel with what's coming up that I know will be good, if that makes sense. Because that, in general, the fear can be quite a hurdle. So it would be nice to have a different attitude toward it. So thank you.
Thank you. Two things really struck me about what you said. One was the idea that I take care of compassion. Like, if I take care of compassion, then that's growing compassion. So I just, that mindset works well for me. And then the other thing is the idea that the afflictions, that the places in the heart that are broken or raging our salvation. In other words, as I learn how in these places, I don't believe they ever really completely resolve. There is a brokenhearted place, I think, in every heart that's broken when you're in it. If you're bearing witness to something that's heartbreaking, you'll be in it with all beings that are in it. And so learning that it's finding a place in the heart that can embrace that without getting rid of it allows me to enter other people's brokenheartedness without a fear that I'll never get out of it because it's a part of our human landscape. So I just like that reminder that I'm never going to completely get rid of greed, anger, delusion.
I need to be kind to them. So that was helpful. Thank you.
I was listening. Somebody had this Leonard Cohen song that they were using in a Dharma talk, and I listened to it this morning. And one of the lines in the song was something like, where there's a crack, when there's a crack, the sun can shine in the crack. I'm not as eloquent as Leonard Cohen. Thank you.